from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In and out of school, American kids are learning on screens. Online tests and homework, e-books, Wikipedia, and now educational apps of all kinds. Apps make big promises, and interactive, entertaining education in your pocket, available for a long car ride, an after-dinner session, or in school at a student's desk for high schoolers, elementary students, and more, preschoolers. How effective are they and for what? This hour on Point, we're looking at the flood of educational apps and the education of our children. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What educational apps are hot in your house, your school, and how much of the education of our kids can be done well, on by apps. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll talk with a pediatrician about the new call for high schools and middle schools to start later to give teenagers more time to sleep. But first, to the world of apps. It may be all over your life, or maybe it's not. Here's one called Monkey Word School Adventure, introducing kids to letters, sight words, phonics, and spelling.
R-O-W. Crow. S.
Monkey Word School. Boy, they got the beat down there. Want to learn a foreign language? Here's the sound from Duolingo, Portuguese lesson. First the user gets it right, then the user gets it wrong.
Tu tens bom livro. Tu tens bom livro. Tu comes pão. Tu comes.
Sad trumpets when you get it wrong. Are you fluent yet in Portuguese? Well, maybe a little more app time, or maybe not. Joining us now from San Francisco is Betsy Corcoran. She's CEO and co-founder of EdSurge, an online news site covering education and technology. They also train teachers on the latest technology. Betsy Corcoran, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So where are we in the wave of educational apps? I mean, we've been hearing about them and using them for years. There are more and more and more out there. Big venture capitalist John Doerr writing that we've got, I don't know, hundreds of millions installed at this point. Is it still on a hockey stick up in terms of penetration and use? Are we plateauing? Where are we, Betsy?
Lots of great questions, Tom. Couple of things I think that are useful to just kind of observe from the get-go, right? All the technology that we're seeing heading towards schools and heading towards kids in the classrooms, I think we can put them in a couple of different buckets. First, there's a class of technology that's really helpful for teachers managing the stuff that they do. And that includes everything from grading to communicating with the kids to getting homework assignments out. Some of the things that John Doerr has invested go right into that category. Like there's a product called Remind that gives teachers a really safe way that they can kind of directly message families of their kids without sort of having to share their cell phone number.
And okay.
Class Dojo is a tool for the teachers use to kind of help manage kids. It's a little bit like the old Gold Star treatment. And there's also the whole class of things like that that are really super helpful for teachers. Then there's a second class of stuff that actually help kids build stuff, which is really exciting, whether that's learning how to program using something called Scratch or using, other things called Little Bits to kind of figure out how to build electronic stuff or tinker. Those are pretty cool. And then there's a whole collection of things that are around actually learning stuff. And some of those are apps, and some of those are much bigger pieces of technology. I think there's a really good question about, are you really going to learn to speak a language, speak Portuguese, by kind of sneaking onto your cell phone in between, subway rides or something like that? That's pretty hard to tell. Some of the more complex tools that we're seeing for the classroom are as sophisticated as any textbook that you've ever wanted to see. And they present some really interesting opportunities. So I think we just kind of need to think a little bit about when we talk about all the technology going to the classroom, Which bucket are we talking about?
Would you say at this point, Betsy, that educational apps are more important in school, in the classroom, or at home when kids preschool or in school are on their own time?
So I think that we see a lot of kids in the world that are at the University of YouTube these days, especially in high school. Where
is that education?
No. That's definitely not it.
Well, it's a kind of education, I suppose.
They're certainly packing their brains with something, but that's not great. So, I mean, if you're asking me, you know, would I rather see kids, you know, on their cell phones using Duolingo or kind of going and watching, you know, lolcat videos online? Sure, it'd be great to see them on Duolingo instead of just doing more cat videos, right? But the real question is, we don't learn by just absorbing information. We learn by doing things. And so the tools, the technology tools that are going to be best and are really going to help people learn are the ones that give them the power to kind of build things and do things.
I guess my question is more about whether we're seeing educational apps and their use being more heavily driven by schools and teachers at this point or by parents and families and kids on their own who want to use them and learn.
Yeah, so we're seeing kind of, again, two different phenomena going on. Upper income parents are buying lots of apps, particularly at the preschool level. So, you know, it's the equivalent of sort of baby Einstein for your toddlers. I think we've kind of gotten past the idea that you're all going to learn how to be Einstein or learn how to play Mozart if you just play Mozart music to your baby. So we are seeing a lot of those kinds of apps, and those really are a combination of entertainment and a little tiny bit of education. But in the classrooms themselves, we're seeing a really, I think, a different phenomenon. We're seeing, again, a lot of technology tools that are really helpful to teachers, used well, and hopefully not just distracting.
We must hope for that, given the penetration of these things. Betsy Corcoran at EdSurge in San Francisco. Thanks for joining us for a minute today, Betsy.
Yeah, thanks.
Joining me now from Washington is Lisa Guernsey, director of the Early Education Initiative at the New America Foundation, author of Screen Time, How Electronic Media from Baby Videos to Educational Software Affects Your Young Child, currently working with the educational nonprofit the Cooney Center to analyze all the educational apps in the App Store at iTunes, Google Play, and Amazon. Lisa Guernsey, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey there, Tom. Great to be here.
How on earth are you setting out to analyze? There are so many apps out there now. How do you even begin to analyze what works, what's good, what maybe isn't?
Exactly. Well, we first narrowed a bit, and we wanted to focus on apps that were aimed at helping children learn to read. And to do that, we also focused on apps that are aimed at younger children at the ages of when they're typically learning to read. So we focused our efforts on apps that are aimed at infants all the way up through third graders, or, you know, 8 and 9 year olds. And then from there, we've been paring down, looking at the top 50 that are listed in the stores, those that are gaining awards from various outlets out there like Children's Technology Review or Parents' Choice. And we've got some analysts, and they're doing a great job. We're still not done with this. We're at the beginning of it. Mm-hmm. We have analysts that are coding each one of these apps as they're downloaded to understand how they're described by the developers, mm-hmm. What features exist within them, and where they fit along a continuum of different kinds of literacy skills that we know children do need to acquire to learn how to read by
them. You could code them on all three of those vectors, how they describe them and so on, and still not necessarily convey if they work or not. How do you assess an educational app for effectiveness, for quality?
That is the million-dollar question right now, and there are a lot of folks in children's libraries, in early literacy centers, in educational institutions that are trying to figure this out. We really need to build some criteria and come to some level of standards about what quality really looks like. There are a couple of things that I'll say from the get-go that we can know for sure to look for. One is you want to make sure that the app is not over-promising, and there's a lot of apps out there that mm-hmm. seem to kind of, you know, as if they are going to make your baby that Einstein, for example. Mm-hmm. And it really pays to be cautious and to dig a little deeper and understand who's developing the apps and why and what they claim. And there are also some new research on what features may be of most use to students or children at different ages or different stages of their development. And we need to start paying attention to that research, particularly for the little kids.
We're going to dive into all that in some detail.
Yes.
Let me just ask you, we got a break coming up here, but if, you know, go back 20, 30, I don't know how many years now, when there was no software teaching people, it was all human transmission. That was 100%. Where do you think we're going to end up here? Is it going to be 50-50, 50% software and 50% humans, or something else?
I really do think it's going to be a mix. I think there's still a huge role for print, and there may be things that we haven't even imagined yet in terms of the ways information is transmitted or the media that are used to transmit it.
Lisa Kernsey, it's great to have you with us. Please stand by. Director of the Early Education Initiative at the New America Foundation. Behind us right here, we have from PBS, the electric company Wordball, an app for smartphones and tablets. Give students an educational song about spelling before they're challenged to combine letters with incomplete words. Here's their song, Silent E. Can you hear that in the back seat with your, I don't know, six-year-old back there? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
A word, and you just add the silent E.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about educational apps, what works, how well they work, and best applications at home and school. Here's a little sound of one, Toontastic Junior, designed by Stanford School of Education and Zoom, San Francisco's Children Museum. Free apps, Toontastic Junior, they help students practice storytelling by helping them pick a setting, character, story structure. Here's some sound of playing around on Toontastic Junior Pirates.
Let's make a cartoon. To start, pick a beginning, a middle, and an ending. Pirate's booty. Hijinks at Pirate's Cove. Scallywag scare. Our story begins. Move your characters around and record your voice.
Pirate's Booty, and you're telling the story. You can go right up to Khan Academy, online learning nonprofit, started back in 06. Now has an app that walks students through tutorials and YouTube-based lessons in English, history, math, and more. Here's a bit from a simple division lesson showing 24 triangles that need to be divided by 3.
So if I divide 24 into 3 equal groups, 1, 2, 3, how many are going to be in each group? Well, we can count that. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 in each group. So we could say that 24 divided by 3 is equal to 8.
Apps, YouTube lessons, there's education all over these days. We're looking at what works, how well, what's the adoption rate, and how much of the education of American children is going to go digital. Lisa Guernsey is with us, director of the Early Education Initiative at the New American Foundation. She's author of Screen Time, How Electronic Media from Baby Videos to Educational Software Affects Our Young Children. With us right now as well from New Haven, Connecticut, is Annie Murphy-Paul, educational columnist for Slate and the Hechinger Report, author of forthcoming Brilliant, The Science of How We Get Smarter. Annie Murphy-Paul, thank you for joining us.
Hi there, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
What's your best guess about how much of the educational activity of our children will ultimately be digital?
Well, the way things are going, a lot, and that concerns me, to be honest. There's a lot that technology has to offer kids, but I think we can't overlook the fact that learning is a social activity. It's something we do with other people. And I think we need to think hard about whether we want our children getting their education from a screen rather than from a teacher.
What's pushing the move to screens? Are they simply irresistible by their nature? Is it business? You've got the big venture capitalist John Doerr out there saying, you know, kids are all going to have smartphones, and this is our educational salvation.
there's a lot of forces pushing technology into education. One of them is this idea, which I think is misinformed, that the younger generation, they're digital natives. They learn best from screens. They almost can't learn without screens and technology. When research in cognitive science and psychology tells us that the human brain works the way it always has, and we are wired to learn from people, from teachers, from peers. It's not to say that we can't learn from screens, but I think we need to carefully consider the content of our children's education and how it's being delivered and not engage in irrational exuberance around educational technology.
Lisa Guernsey, you hear the note of skepticism there, and yet it feels as if we're still, after everything that's out there, we're still kind of early days in terms of integrating digital education into our overall arc of education. I mean, do you have a sense of where we are, and do we necessarily lose the human element as we get more apps in gear here?
I do think it's early days, and I really understand where Annie's comments are coming from, I think we have to recognize that the technology is taking many different forms in many different contexts and is, in fact, in some cases, providing platforms for collaboration and socialization in ways that are very different than, you know, my generation. I'm my early 40s. You know, I used to think of kind of screens as solo activities, you know, playing Pac-Man mindlessly by yourself. Mm-hmm. The kids today who are engaging with different kinds of collaborative experiences online, they're seeing it very differently than that. And it is a more kind of social experience. That's not to say that there's mindless junk out there, because there really is, and we have to become very savvy, alert, and I think skeptical, absolutely, to various claims that are being made. But there are new ways that technology is being used, depending on the context and the content, and the individual child. I often talk about those three C's: content, context, and the individual child. And we've got to be thinking about those three when we think about where technology makes sense.
We're going to look at that in some detail. I want to get our listeners in right away. Lots of opinions out there about educational apps for kids and beyond. John in Austin, Texas. Thank you for calling. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm by no means an app hater. I love them. I'm learning how to speak Italian. I've learned how to play bridge. I've used apps for all kinds of stuff.
Awesome.
But what really, really worries me about the whole thing is they're great at answering questions like how and what. How do you do this?
Mm-hmm.
If you ask why, the app will sit and stare dumbfounded at you, like, what in the world is that question supposed to be? And that is the question that little kids ask all the time. Why? And nobody can answer it, and our society is getting less and less capable of answering that question, to the point where if you want to learn, great. If you don't want to learn, nobody can explain why you should.
John, that's a really interesting point here. Let us pick it up. Annie, I mean, I hear what John's saying, and why is a critical question, but is there some reason that Salman Khan can't answer why when it comes to something about math, or, you know, some other great philosopher can't also be in an app? Or do apps have a why problem?
I think there is a why question, especially when we're talking about very young children. That shared context, you know, that feeling of we're in the same room at the same time, I can look to you, the adult, and check in with you to see what's going on, that's something an app can't do. And so it produces something that researchers call the video deficit, where young children literally can't learn from videos or apps what they can learn very readily and easily from adults, from just natural interaction with older people. So, yeah, there's definitely a why problem, because the app is not sharing a reality with the child who's using it.
But you're saying can't learn, then I become skeptical. I mean, surely they can learn a lot of things, even if it's not the ultimate answers.
Well, again, I'm talking about very young children. This is children up to the age of 3. I am skeptical of using technology with children at all under you know, at that age. As they get older, yes, of course, we can learn using tools, apps as tools, the way we use books as tools.
But what is your skepticism about younger kids? I mean, I just heard from a family member over the weekend about a very young niece. She's two and something, and the first thing she says when grandma shows up is iPad, because she wants to trace letters and do lots of what look like educational things on that iPad, Annie. What's the downside?
Well, that sounds awfully sad to me that her first word upon seeing grandma is iPad.
Well, I don't know if it's sad or not, but there's a lot of enthusiasm. You know, people feel like you've got to get going. You've got to get your kid ahead of the game. If they're drawing the alphabet at 2.5, it feels like Yahoo.
Well, you know, we mentioned earlier the Baby Einstein videos. That actually, watching the Baby Einstein videos is associated with a smaller vocabulary than children who don't watch the videos. And one thing that concerns me about technology in children is, what researchers call time displacement. It's not so much that the apps and the technology are doing something bad to children, as that every hour that you spend looking at a screen, you're not spending an hour interacting face to face with another human. You're not manipulating things in the physical world. You're not
on somebody's back out in the garden looking at tomatoes coming off the vine.
Yeah, well, you know. That's how children learn, and I think we need to respect that and not force our own ideas of what they should be doing at age 2.
I love to have the kids in the garden, but Lisa, what about it? Nothing before age 3, Annie says. Do you agree?
I don't. I think that we have to look at the research, what we have so far. So there's a lot that's been centered on the ages of 2 and 3, and it's fascinating research, actually, because there's a huge developmental changes going on during that time. What I've seen in the literature so far is that we don't have a lot of evidence of learning solely from a screen up to about 22 to 24 months of age. So I absolutely grant the point that before those ages, there may be really no value for passive viewing for a child that doesn't have anybody interacting with them, sitting on their lap together, looking at something together and talking about it. After 24 months, however, things get a little different. And the research is still, it's nascent, and we're still learning a lot. There's huge differences between interactive media versus passive or linear video. But we are seeing that there might be something going on with interactive media in children around 3 or even younger than 3 in that 24 to 36-month age range. That video deficit that Annie mentioned, I think that's a really important concept, but we need to understand that it differs depending on what children are asked to learn from the screen, whether it's a task to go find an object that's hidden or it's learning a new word. And it also is something that has been found to fade after children have had a couple of additional repetitions of seeing something. Not that any of that means we should at all replace social interaction with screen-based learning. Not at all. But I think that there's some context and some texture to this that a lot of families today are seeing with their own eyes as they're using these tools with young children. They're wondering, wait, how is it that my, 30-month-old learned this word that I've never uttered? Wow, maybe it was something they saw on screen.
I mean, there's a lot that's intuitive here, that you don't want to give up the time in the garden, the face-to-face, hand-to-hand play time, but also that with all the information that is stuffed into the digital realm, surely somehow we can leverage this to human advantage, but also that we need that social context. Marie writes to us on Facebook, says, "Arg, could we just limit classrooms to 20 students each and have a textbook for each student? Is that so much to ask?" But Tiffany says, "This conversation is so much bigger than apps, but it is safe to say that given the dynamic world in which we and our students now live and will forever live, textbooks absolutely no longer suffice." Nick in Hampton, Virginia. Nick, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Howdy, Tom. I'm a teacher with Hampton City Schools who's charged with distributing iPads to almost 600 kids.
Whoa, okay, so you're right in the thick of it. What do you think?
Well, you know, our district made a tremendous investment in iPads for all students in grades 5 through 8. And all middle school teachers were also issued iPads. And so we're challenged with coming up with sort of the bleeding edge of curriculum management and delivery of content, but also getting the teachers on some of the same level as the kids.
How's it going?
It's going well, but there's challenges in all things in education. And there's going to be ongoing challenges in establishing the appropriate balance between traditional school activities like cutting and pasting with scissors and glue sticks and coloring with markers and accessing digital multimedia on screens.
Do you see teachers eager to adopt use of these things, or are they leaving them on the shelves unused, or are they just handing them out and going for a coffee break while the students do who knows what?
I think you're going to see various levels of enthusiasm depending on the capability levels of the instructors. This is my third year teaching, and I'm pumped about it. And I'm excited to work for a district that embraces the technology, but I have older colleagues who they have a lot of great experience in the classroom, but they're more comfortable with the traditional media that I said earlier, and we're all working together to bring everybody up to the same level.
Nick, I wish you good luck with that. Annie, there's Nick who's making it happen in Hampton, Virginia. I'm reading here in a publication from Hechinger, I think you work with it, about 63% of the country's schools do not have the required internet connectivity. This is according to Education Superhighway. It's a nonprofit that enables more schools. So I don't know, but there's that issue. And then there's just the money issue. Here in a stagnant economy, I'm reading here, contracting for a $205 million technology plan over 7 years raised debates in Baltimore County, people asking why the district should spend money on devices rather than teachers. First, what about sheer high-speed access to internet, which is kind of a baseline? And then what about the relative, you know, the question of where do you put scarce dollars, digital or human?
Well, you can probably guess my answer. You know, there's been a number of studies that suggest that when high-speed internet comes to communities or comes to schools, often grades go down. I mean, another concern that I have about technology in schools and in the lives of young people is the potential for distraction, for divided attention once we introduce, you know, the whole world via the internet when we're trying to teach kids to pay attention to what's in front of them. So, yeah, I think scarce dollars, and they certainly are scarce these days, should be spent on training teachers and investing in what goes on in the classroom between teachers and students rather than technology. That would be my choice.
Lisa, the venture capitalist John Doerr's message seems to be, we don't have our education working correctly or working well. This is our salvation. So, you know, it seems to go the other way.
Yeah.
If you have scarce dollars, use it for digital because we can at least sort of centralize quality online.
I don't think we have the evidence to go that far, honestly. And this is where I think Annie and I may agree. And we've talked about this offline before as well. Uh-huh. But human capital is really critical in recognizing as something to recognize in how we educate our youngsters in the next generation. And it has to start with people. And where I think we may differ is starting to recognize what it means to be a teacher, an educator, or a mentor, or a guide in the 21st century. From what I'm looking at, I'm seeing that those people who are so integral and absolutely should be first and foremost in where we invest, they need the training to think about how to use technology with the kids that they're working with.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about educational apps. What works, how well, and best applications at home and school. Here's one called ABC Mouse Virtual Zoo. Let students explore subjects like reading, math, music, and science. Virtual Zoo, well, here teaching them about animals like the lion.
The male lion is very large and has fur around his face, called a mane. What do we call a family group of lions that live together? A club, a hopper, a pride. That's right. A family group of lions that live together is called a pride.
club, a hopper, or a pride, and if you guess pride, you're right. If not, hopefully, you're learning. Education apps all over the place. Lisa Guernsey is with us from the Early Education Initiative at the New America Foundation. Annie Murphy-Paul, columnist for Slate and the Hechinger Report. We'll talk a little later in this hour about the new call for high schools to start classes earlier, or later, I should say, so that teenagers can sleep in. Let's go to our listeners, Jordan in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Jordan, you're on the air. What do you know?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
As an educator, I'm really fascinated in kind of echoing Lisa and Annie's points and Nick's point from earlier that there is a constant influx of these apps. And as an educator educating future instructors, how do we quality control them, one, but how are we teaching them to use them? The best ones we're really limited to, in a lot of ways, what email gets sent to us from what business or company promoting their app, or also who has the most positive reviews on the App Store or
right.
the Android market. So we are really limited in choosing the best tools and remembering that they are tools. They're just devices that we teach our students to use when they become teachers, or we teach our mentors to take to the schools that they're working in. So it's fascinating to me, this increase, this constant increase of new apps, yet not much time on the educator's part to learn all of them and how to use them properly.
And to screen them and adopt them well, that is a great question. Lisa, we know very well that textbooks go through a lot of review before they hit classrooms, for better or worse, but usually better. You can just imagine teachers or schools or school districts up against this flood of apps trying to figure out what's good and what's not. I mean, I know you're working on this, but this could go on forever. Is there any sort of formal review process that apps go through before they end up in our classes that would be equivalent to what we did with textbooks?
There are different ways that districts might handle this. And we should also recognize that there are some districts that are, or schools that are deciding it's not really apps so much that they need to get information on. It's websites or platforms, software, packages, et cetera.
Yep.
But if you think about all of those together, there are some cases where they're going through some kind of review. An instructional technologist at a district level has a peer group nationally that are talking about what seems to be worthwhile and what isn't. There might be some folks in particular subject areas that are starting to home in on what they really are seeing as quality. However, there's no real coordination of a lot of this. We're in such early days. I think about, you know, the days before the Dewey Decimal System, for example, and the way we were organizing printed materials and how hard that was to do until there seemed to be some new structures for doing so. So we desperately need those structures. We need experts. We need folks who are not connected to companies and have vested interests through the technology industry.
Will they be state education boards or something along those lines, like textbooks? Is that in the works?
There are some states that are including digital textbooks in their textbook approval processes in the say 20 or so states that have those kind of processes at the state level. But even there, I mean, whether the people on the state boards really even know what to look for in those digital textbooks and whether they're able to review them at the content level that's needed. I mean, these are really big questions that we need to start thinking about and getting answers to.
Let's go to Detroit and Sophia. Sophia, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm just really concerned about the social implications and the possible future health complications of moving towards this system, which is based off of mobile phones and computers and Wi-Fi and whatnot. And I'm a psychologist and previous educator, and I'm just seeing the sheer numbers of increase of clientele coming in with learning difficulties, but also serious issues of depression due to real loneliness and a lack of empathy. And if you are an educator, you know that those things like cutting and pasting is developing the hand-eye motor coordination, which
yeah.
helps develop the prefrontal cortex, where you have empathy development.
It's also about sharing the scissors.
Yeah, exactly. But it's also about cutting shapes mm-hmm. and having to, which stimulates that part of the brain, which is the part of the brain that helps develop empathy. And I can't help but wonder, you know, with, you know, we're just, school shootings used to be so unusual. And now it's just almost every year there's a few, and teachers and people, colleagues, they're all concerned about the lack of empathy between teens and at university. Most of my colleagues, we're now seeing the generation coming up that were basically raised with computers, but not to the degree it is now.
Sophia, let us pick it up right there. I very much appreciate your call from Detroit. Annie, how about it? The screen isolation, empathy impaired, does it sound like a real risk factor here, or worth it for the what we learn off those screens?
I think some concern is justified there. There's some research just out this week that suggests that kids who are always looking at a screen, at a smartphone, at a tablet, are less able to read the faces of the people around them. And when you ask sixth graders to stop looking at screens for a week, they get better at looking at faces and reading what the expression is conveying. So, I wouldn't go so far as to tie it to school shootings, but I certainly think that we need to think about how our children spend their time. And the research suggests that kids are spending 7 and more hours a day. Children ages 8 to 18 are spending 7-plus hours a day with media. And so this is, you know, what you do with your time is who you become. I think we need to give that a lot of thought.
Drew in Salado, Texas. Drew, thanks for calling.
Hi there, Tom.
Hi.
As a teacher, I've seen it firsthand. I've watched, you know, every sixth grader I had a Mac. And my job, I teach special ed, my job became just watching what they're on and preventing them from, you know, watching something bad.
You mean your job was just to monitor their screen use instead of teaching them directly?
Correct. That's what it's becoming. And a lot of teachers feel the same way I do, that, you know, eventually it's just going to be a monitor, you know, a person to monitor them, you know, and make sure they're not on porn or whatever,
So turning teachers into monitors or babysitters and gluing kids to the screens. Lisa, you hear Drew, and he's saying, firsthand, it's happening with him. Do you see a risk of that nationally?
That dystopian image certainly comes through in interviews that I do with teachers that are getting concerned about what's going on, feeling that they don't have control over their classrooms in the way they did in the past. But I will say that there's also evidence from teachers who feel very empowered by tools that they are able to engage children on deeper levels. So it really comes down to me to what is it that you're trying to teach to which children in what context? And the age of the child matters so much. The way that the people around the kids and the students are talking to them and engaging them with the content on the screen, mm-hmm. helping them to look up and see the world around them and how it relates to content. Those are just incredibly important skills for the teachers of tomorrow and the teachers of today. And I'll just go back to what I said earlier. I'm just not sure that our teacher prep institutions or teacher training are even ways of thinking about what teaching is. We're not ready yet, or we're not doing it everything we need to make sure that we're putting the person first, but recognizing that if they're going to be using tools in their lives as they're working with students, and those tools are going to take many different forms, and we need to give them some guidance on how to use those in ways that help children actually learn content and critical thinking and
socialize.
Clearly
want to tap the value of this whole arena and avoid the pitfalls. If you've got one resource online for people to look to, Lisa, what would it be?
for more information about, well, certainly edcentral.org, where we do a lot of writing on this, is certainly one place. But I think that the journals on social science are a good place to start. The Society for Research and Child Development's been doing some really interesting publishing on these.
Sounds like
topics.
A tall order for ordinary mom and pop, but maybe. Lisa Guernsey with the Early Education Initiative at the New America Foundation, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Annie Murphy-Paul, one resource you'd point people to?
CommonSenseMedia.org is a nonprofit organization that rates apps and other technologies for how well they promote learning, and I use it all the time with my own kids. It's fantastic.
CommonSenseMedia.org, EdCentral. We'll take both of those. Annie Murphy-Paul, columnist for Slate and the Hechinger Report, author of Look For It, Brilliant, coming out. Annie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
In a moment, we'll talk about the American Academy of Pediatrics' new recommendation that high school and middle school start no earlier than 8:30 a.m. to let teens sleep. This is On Point. That new report from the American Academy of Pediatrics says that teenagers need 8.5 to 9.5 hours of sleep a night, and only 1 in 5 are getting it. They're recommending that high schools and middle schools start no earlier than 8:30 a.m. It's a little late for this year, but we want to hear their thinking. With me now from Washington is the lead author of the recommendations, Dr. Judith Owens. She's director of the Sleep Medicine Center at Children's National Health System. Dr. Owens, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Why exactly are you saying don't start too early schools?
Well, we know that, as you mentioned, the average teenager in the United States gets far less than the 8.5 to 9.5 hours of sleep that they require.
So go to bed earlier.
Well, that's easier said than done. And the reason for that is primarily biological. At around the time that teenagers go through puberty, they also develop a change in their circadian rhythm system.
Okay.
So that, for the most part, they're absolutely not able to fall asleep much before 11 p.m. And if you do the math, if they need 8.5 to 9.5 hours of sleep, that means they're biologically programmed to wake at around 8. And that's a time when many of them are already halfway through their first period class.
Now, we see this report that 59% of middle schoolers, 87% of high schoolers are getting less than that 8.5 to 9.5 hours of sleep. But what percentage of schools do you know are starting at earlier than 8:30 a.m.?
About 40% of schools start before 8 a.m. So that means that the majority, 60%, start at 8 or later, but very few of them start at 8:30 or later or 9 o'clock or later. So we still have some room to go here.
What kind of reaction are you getting to your recommendation? Are schools, districts, principals saying, you know, get out of here. We can't start that late. It'll push everything back. Teachers will hate it. I don't know what. What kind of reaction?
Well, I think overwhelmingly positive. And we have been working with many school districts around the country and regionally to help them realize this change, delay in school start times. And I don't in any way minimize the challenges that are involved from a political, logistical, and mm-hmm. even financial standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, this really is a public health issue. And what we are condemning our adolescents to are serious health, physical and mental health, safety and performance concerns. And if delaying school start times can mitigate some of those effects, then I think it's truly worthwhile for school districts to seriously consider it.
What are some of the challenges we would be up to in moving those times back? You listed a couple generically, but give us some sense of the detail there.
Well, in some communities, it requires an increased number of buses. But actually, in other communities, they've saved money because they've been able to go to a tiered busing system. So the bus drops off one group of students and then comes back and picks up another. Childcare is certainly an issue, traffic patterns. But, you know, we actually looked at the some thousand high schools across the country in 70 school districts that have successfully implemented the start time delay. And first of all, almost none of them have gone back to the original start time. And furthermore, a lot of the concerns that were initially anticipated did not turn out to be what actually happened. And so a lot of this is resistance to change, kind of, you know, keeping the status quo. But in those schools that have taken the leap, they've seen a lot of positive benefits.
Do you have proof of the pudding in the performance of schools that start at 8:30 or later? Do they have better educational results, Dr. Owens?
Yes. So we see improvements in grades. We see increased standardized test scores. We see improved attendance rates, lower tardiness, and even better dropout rates. So it has really incredible benefits across the board.
And mood-wise, are we going to have happier schools if kids can sleep until a little later?
Absolutely. We know that chronic sleep loss in teens is associated with an increased rate of depression and even of suicidal thoughts. And that delaying school start times addresses some of those very important problems.
So if there were going to be changes, it's too late for this school year. When does the school board or the principal start talking about it for next year?
Well, I think this is the perfect time to do that. You know, what we've realized in talking to other school districts is that it takes about a year or even two to kind of get the whole community engaged, the principal stakeholders involved, to allow families enough time to prepare and change their schedules. So this is a great time to start the dialogue.
Dr. Judith Owens is Director of Sleep Medicine at Children's National Health System. She's lead author of the American Academy of Pediatrics policy statement, School Start Times for Adolescents. They're recommending high school and middle school start no earlier than 8:30 a.m. That would mean a lot of change in a lot of places. Dr. Owens, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. Always great to have you right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.